Hey everyone, and welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into a case that's, well, it's a pretty big deal in environmental law, Massachusetts versus EPA.
Yeah.
Decided way back in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
But its legacy, oh, it's still shaping legal battles and policies even now in 2025.
Right.
So get ready, because we're going to unpack not just what the court decided.
Right.
But why it still matters for you listening in, especially if you're, well, if you're working with environmental law.
Absolutely. Yeah, this case is, it's foundational. I mean, it's about states fighting for their very existence, a legal, a showdown, really, over just one word, substance.
Okay.
And Supreme Court, they had to wade into, you know, the very politically charged waters of climate change.
So set the scene for us. Rising sea levels, slowly, you know, creeping up on the coastline, threatening to just swallow up the land. This isn't some sci-fi movie. This was really happening to Massachusetts,
right,
a bunch of other states, too.
Yeah.
And so they decided to sue the Environmental Protection Agency. We all know them as the EPA, claiming the agency was, well, they said the EPA was basically dropping the ball on regulating these greenhouse gases from vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So what were the states even arguing? Like, what was their main point?
So basically, they were saying that the EPA, they weren't doing their job under the Clean Air Act.
Okay.
You know, the part about regulating pollutants that are dangerous for public health and welfare. Their argument was that greenhouse gases, especially from cars, were contributing to climate change, which, as we all know now, causes sea levels to rise. And that was directly threatening their coastlines. And this wasn't just like a hypothetical harm. They were already experiencing losses, real losses.
So it wasn't enough to just say, hey, climate change is bad. Mm. They had to really draw that straight line between those emissions, those rising seas, and then the actual threat to their land.
Exactly, yeah. And that's where this idea of standing comes into play. Did these states, did they even have the right to bring this lawsuit? Could they actually prove that they were being harmed in a way that the courts could actually do something about? This was a big deal.
Because, well, I mean, if they didn't have standing, their case would just get tossed out.
Exactly.
It wouldn't even get started.
No. Yeah. But the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, said, yes, Massachusetts, you have standing. And this is where things get interesting.
Okay.
They recognize this special status of states, calling them quasi-sovereign.
Okay, hold on. Quasi-sovereign. That's a pretty fancy term.
Yeah.
What does it really mean? Why does it even matter in this case?
It basically means that states have a unique role. They have this heightened interest in protecting their land, their environment,
mm-hmm.
and just the well-being of all their citizens. It's not just about being a plaintiff in any old lawsuit. It's about their inherent responsibility to actually safeguard their territory. The court was basically saying, look, states aren't like any other entity. They have this power, this responsibility, and we're going to give them special consideration when they're trying to protect their interests, you know.
So just being a state, it gave them extra legal muscle in this case.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about Massachusetts being worried. They had this quasi-sovereign right to stand up and be like, hey, EPA, you're neglecting your duties, and it's directly impacting our land, our people.
Exactly. And this whole idea of the state's quasi-sovereign interest, well, it's had huge ripple effects, much bigger than just this case. It's been used in lots of environmental lawsuits since then, giving states a much stronger legal footing when they're challenging, federal agencies or even other states on, you know, all these environmental issues.
So this kind of obscure legal term, quasi-sovereign, it ended up having a massive impact on how environmental law is actually enforced.
Yeah.
But this is just Act One. The court, they also had to figure out whether carbon dioxide, CO2, you know, the poster child for greenhouse gases, if it even counted as an air pollutant under the Clean Air Act. So why was this such a big sticking point?
Well, you got to remember, the Clean Air Act was written like way back in 1970.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Their focus was on things like smog, soot, you know, the stuff we could actually see and smell. The EPA argued that Congress back then, they weren't thinking about climate change at all when they wrote the law. So CO2, they said it shouldn't even be considered a pollutant along with those traditional ones.
So it's this battle of legal interpretation. What did the court say about this? Did they side with the EPA?
Actually, no. Uh-huh. They went with a much broader view. They looked at the Clean Air Act and said, okay, it defines an air pollutant as any air pollution agent or combination of such agents, including any physical, chemical, substance or matter which is emitted into or otherwise enters the ambient air.
So they're like, CO2 is a substance, it gets into the air, that's it, end of story.
Yeah, pretty much. They were saying that the EPA was reading limitations into the law that just weren't there. The Clean Air Act was broad enough to cover greenhouse gases, even if, you know, even if Congress in 1970 didn't specifically picture this specific application.
And this is where it gets super interesting.
Yeah.
Because this broad interpretation of air pollutant, I mean, it has massive implications.
Yeah.
It opens the door for the EPA to regulate a whole bunch of stuff, not just the classic pollutants that they were worried about before.
You're absolutely right. This set a big precedent, and it really expanded the EPA's reach, like, significantly. But as you can imagine, not everyone was happy about that, especially the Bush administration at the time.
Oh, yes.
They weren't exactly big on climate action.
So even though the court was saying, EPA, you have the authority to regulate these greenhouse gases, yeah, the Bush administration was like, yeah, we hear you, but we're not going to do it. How did that even, could they just ignore a Supreme Court ruling like that?
And that's where we get into the really fascinating and often pretty controversial world of administrative law.
Okay.
The question becomes, how much freedom does an agency like the EPA actually have when they're interpreting and then implementing laws?
Because on the one hand, you've got the court saying, this is the law, EPA, do your job.
Yeah.
But then you've got the executive branch, the president, his people,
right,
who might have different priorities. So how did the court even handle that?
Well, they basically said, EPA, you can't just pick and choose which parts of the law to enforce. They were very clear that agencies can't just ignore a law because they don't like it, even if the president agrees with them. They have a duty to act if they find that something's endangering public health or welfare, and that includes, well, that includes regulating CO2.
So the court was drawing a line. They were saying, yes, agencies have some leeway, but they can't disregard the law just because it clashes with their political agenda.
Exactly. And they made it very clear that agencies, they can't just make up flimsy excuses for not taking action. They have to have solid scientific reasons for their decisions.
So this sets up this really fascinating tension that we still see playing out in environmental law all the time. The balance of power between the courts, Congress, the president, these agencies, it's always in motion.
Absolutely. And that's why cases like Massachusetts versus EPA, they're so important. They define the boundaries, they set the precedents for all these future legal battles.
But before we go any further, we need to remember this wasn't a unanimous decision. Four justices disagreed, and their dissents, they bring up some really important questions about, you know, the role of the courts, agency expertise,
right,
and just the limits of what the law can do for a problem that's, well, as complicated as climate change.
Yeah, you're right. We can't just ignore those dissenting voices. Their points, especially the ones about the potential for courts overreaching and how tricky it is to prove cause and effect with a global problem like climate change, those are still being debated today.
Okay, so we've set the stage. We've got a divided court, a powerful precedent set, and a whole lot of questions about how this decision is actually going to work in the real world. So get ready, everyone, because in our next act, we're going to dive into those dissenting voices. We're going to explore their concerns and see how they all connect to what's happening today, both legally and politically. Welcome back, everyone. So before we went to our little break there, we were talking about the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts v. EPA, you know, the case that really changed things when it came to climate change and the EPA's power to regulate greenhouse gases.
Right.
But we mentioned that it wasn't a totally unanimous decision.
Yeah.
Four justices had some pretty strong disagreements, and those arguments are still being debated today. So let's get into those dissenting voices. What were their main concerns?
Well, the dissenting opinions, they really highlight some of the big tensions in environmental law.
Okay.
Especially when we're dealing with, well, complex global issues like climate change. Chief Justice Roberts, he wrote the main dissent, and he really focused on the issue of standing.
Yes, indeed.
He was arguing that Massachusetts hadn't actually shown a direct link between the EPA's, you know, failure to regulate those vehicle emissions and the specific harm that they were facing, the loss of that coastal land because of the rising sea levels.
So he wasn't necessarily saying climate change wasn't real.
Oh.
or that the seas weren't rising.
Yeah.
It was more about the legal technicality of proving that what the EPA did or didn't do was the actual cause of Massachusetts' injury. Yeah. He was saying, yeah, okay, you've got a problem, but can you really blame the EPA for this?
Exactly, yeah. He said that the chain of causation was too speculative. Like, even if the EPA regulated all the greenhouse gases from every car, would it even be enough to solve this global climate change problem? He used that, you know, that drop in the bucket argument, like saying, sure, we can try to lower emissions, but is it even going to make a dent when you've got China and India, all these other countries still pumping out CO2?
It's a really interesting point. Climate change is a worldwide problem, right? And it can feel impossible to pinpoint exactly how much each source contributes to it.
Yeah.
But wasn't there another big argument in the dissent? Something about agencies and their expertise.
Yeah. Justice Scalia, he was known for his very strict interpretation of legal texts. He didn't agree with the majority's kind of expansive reading of the Clean Air Act.
Okay.
He thought the court should have just deferred to the EPA's own understanding of the law. Remember, the EPA had said that the Clean Air Act from 1970 didn't specifically talk about climate change. They didn't picture regulating greenhouse gases for that reason.
So it's that classic debate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Should courts just stick to the literal words of a law, even if it leads to outcomes that the original lawmakers maybe didn't even think about?
Mm.
Or should they give more weight to the expertise of the agencies, you know, the ones actually implementing the laws, even though those agencies could be swayed by politics?
Exactly.
It's a question that gets right to the heart of administrative law and how the different branches of government balance their power. And this case also brings up another worry that was in those dissents.
Yeah.
The fear of the courts, you know, overstepping their bounds.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the justices were worried that this decision would basically let courts make policy decisions.
Yeah.
Decisions that should really be left to the elected branches of government.
That's right. They were saying that if courts could just force agencies to regulate anything that might be seen as a threat to public health or welfare, you know, no matter how broadly you define those terms, it would really blur the lines between interpreting the law and actually making policy.
Right.
They were worried about the judiciary getting too powerful, basically acting like a super legislature.
So even though the majority ended up siding with Massachusetts, these dissenting opinions raise some really crucial questions that are still part of the conversation in environmental law today.
Mm.
Questions about standing, about the role of agency expertise, and the right boundaries between the different parts of our government.
Absolutely. And these questions have become even more important lately, especially with cases like West Virginia v. EPA, where the Supreme Court, they signal that they're maybe a little more skeptical now of agency power, especially when it comes to big, big issues like climate change. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Before we jump into the long-term effects of Massachusetts v. EPA, I think it's important to understand just how much this case changed things.
Yeah.
It wasn't just something for legal scholars to think about. It had real consequences.
Right, because legal decisions, they don't exist in a vacuum. They have a ripple effect. They shape policies, they influence how agencies do their work, and they even spark new lawsuits.
Yeah.
So let's trace those ripples.
Mm.
How did Massachusetts v. EPA actually change the way we think about climate change and environmental regulation?
Well, one of the most immediate outcomes, and a really significant one, was the EPA's their endangerment finding in 2009.
The endangerment finding. This was a big deal, right? Explain what that was and how it's connected to Massachusetts v. EPA.
So the endangerment finding was basically the EPA officially saying greenhouse gases are a threat to public health and welfare. Remember, the Supreme Court in Massachusetts v. EPA had said that the EPA, they had to regulate pollutants that endangered public health, public welfare,
right,
and that this included greenhouse gases. So the endangerment finding was basically the EPA saying, okay, we get it, and the science shows that, yep, these gases really are a big threat.
So Massachusetts v. EPA basically forced the EPA's hand.
Yeah.
They couldn't just say, we don't think these gases are a problem anymore. They had to look at the science and make a decision. And that decision, it gave them the legal reason to actually start regulating those emissions.
Exactly. Yeah. It was like the key that unlocked the door to doing something real about climate change.
Okay.
And it led to some pretty big changes in policy, like stricter fuel efficiency rules for cars,
mm-hmm,
and the Clean Power Plan, which was all about lowering emissions from power plants.
So the impact of this case just spread everywhere. It's amazing to think that this lawsuit started by just a few states about emissions from cars ended up changing how we deal with climate change on a national scale.
It really shows the power of legal precedent, how one single case can reshape an entire area of law. But that's not even the end of the story. Massachusetts v. EPA didn't just influence federal regulations, it had a huge impact on climate litigation as a whole.
And that's an area that's gotten really heated lately.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing so many more lawsuits now from both states and individuals challenging the government for not doing enough about climate change.
Right.
So how did Massachusetts v. EPA pave the way for this new ways of litigation?
Well, go back to what those states were arguing in Massachusetts v. EPA. They were basically saying the government not regulating these emissions is hurting us directly.
Uh-huh.
That's the core of a nuisance claim, right? One party's actions are interfering with another party's ability to use and enjoy their own property.
Mm. So even though the case was about car emissions, it created this legal framework for holding polluters responsible for the wider impacts of climate change.
Yeah.
Things like rising sea levels, extreme weather events, and damaged ecosystems.
Exactly. And we've seen this in cases like Julian of the United States, where a group of young people sued the federal government, saying that its inaction on climate change was violating their constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property. They basically said that the government was contributing to this nuisance that was directly harming their future.
It's interesting to see how this concept of nuisance, which is usually used in property disputes between like neighbors,
yeah,
has been applied to this massive global issue of climate change.
Yeah.
But like you said before, the legal landscape is always shifting, and some more recent Supreme Court decisions they've cast a shadow of doubt over what the future impact of Massachusetts v. EPA will be. So before we wrap up, let's explore that tension between precedent and how the law is being interpreted, mm-hmm. You know, it's changing. Welcome back to The Deep Dive, everyone. We're in the final act of our deep dive into Massachusetts v. EPA. We've talked about a lot, mm-hmm. from that first legal fight over standing and what air pollutants even means, to those dissenting opinions and how the case has rippled out to climate policy and all these lawsuits. But as we know, the legal landscape, it never sits still.
Right.
New cases come up, interpretations change, and that balance of power between the courts, Congress, and those agencies, it's always in motion.
Yeah, it's dynamic.
So where does that leave us? How should lawyers and law students, especially those working on environmental stuff,
yeah,
how should they navigate all this ever-changing terrain?
That's a really important question. And I think the biggest takeaway is this. While Massachusetts v. EPA is still a really strong precedent,
mm-hmm.
how much it impacts things going forward really depends on how those lower courts interpret it, you know, especially in light of more recent decisions,
mm-hmm.
and how the Supreme Court might rule on climate cases that come up in the future. There's definitely some uncertainty there, especially after cases like West Virginia v. EPA, which seem to show that the court's thinking on agency power might be shifting.
Right. That case, it brought in this major questions doctrine, which, mm-hmm. basically says courts should be wary of agencies claiming all this power to regulate, you know, huge economic and political issues,
mm-hmm.
unless Congress has specifically said they can.
Right.
So how does that even affect the legacy of Massachusetts v. EPA?
Well, it could limit how much power the EPA actually has to regulate those greenhouse gases.
Uh-huh.
The court in Massachusetts v. EPA said the EPA had a duty to do that, to regulate. Right. But what West Virginia v. EPA suggests is that the court now, they might be more hesitant to give agencies that kind of power unless Congress has been super clear in the actual words of the law.
Okay.
It's a reminder that even landmark decisions, they can be reinterpreted or narrowed down as the makeup of the court changes and as legal ideas, well, as they evolve.
So for lawyers and law students working on these environmental cases, it means they've got to be even more strategic, more careful when they're putting together their arguments.
Yeah, yeah.
They can't just lean on those broad statements from Massachusetts v. EPA. They've got to anticipate those counterarguments and find ways to base their claims on more specific language in the law, or really clearly show that link between what the agency's doing and the harm that's being done.
Absolutely. You have to really understand the nuances of these cases,
mm-hmm.
the arguments on both sides, and how to create a story, a narrative that's strong enough to stand up to a court that's, well, a court that's getting more and more skeptical of these big sweeping regulations. It's about finding that balance where you're pushing for strong environmental protection, but also respecting the limits of what agencies can do and how laws should be interpreted.
So it's a tightrope walk, but an incredibly important one. But let's switch gears a bit and talk about what Massachusetts v. EPA actually means for legal professionals, you know, the practical stuff. What are some of the key takeaways, the lessons everyone should remember?
Well, one of the biggest is that you've got to prove real harm.
Okay.
If you're saying an agency shouldn't have done something or should have done something, you can't just make vague claims about the environment being damaged. You need to show the court that your client, they're being hurt, there's a real injury, and that what the agency did or didn't do is directly contributing to that injury.
So it's a thing like Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Show those judges the rising sea levels, those ecosystems that are in trouble, the economic losses. Paint a vivid picture of the damage and make it clear that the agency's inaction is making the problem worse.
Exactly. Yeah. And don't just focus on the environmental damage itself. Connect it to people. Show how people's lives are being affected, their jobs, their health. Make it personal. Make it something the court can connect with, something they can't ignore.
That's a powerful point. It's not just about abstract legal stuff. It's about real people dealing with real consequences. What's another key takeaway?
Another big one is about how rules are made. When agencies are proposing new rules or changing old ones, they can't just do it randomly.
No way.
They have to have a good reason, and that reason has to be based on the actual law, not just what they want politically.
So no more hiding behind, you know, vague excuses or political agendas.
Right, exactly. Massachusetts v. EPA showed us that agencies can't just pick and choose the parts of the law they like and ignore the rest. They have to show their work. They have to show how their decisions line up with what the law actually says and be ready to defend those decisions in court.
So sharp legal minds, they've got to hold those agencies accountable, make sure they're playing by the rules.
Absolutely, yeah. And for anyone involved in climate litigation, remember that Massachusetts v. EPA opened up this whole new way of holding polluters accountable for the bigger impacts of climate change. It showed that those nuisance claims, the ones we usually see in property disputes, can be a really strong weapon in the fight against climate change.
It reminds us that sometimes the best legal strategies come from finding creative ways to use existing legal ideas for new challenges that are always coming up.
Yeah.
But as we wrap up our deep dive here, I want to leave everyone listening with something to think about. Remember how the court in Massachusetts v. EPA said that the Clean Air Act, how it defines an air pollutant, that it was broad enough to include those greenhouse gases?
Mm-hmm.
They were basically saying it's a substance, it's in the air, it's regulated. Mm-hmm. But think about all the new tech and industries popping up today, nanomaterials, AI, synthetic biology, all that. What kind of air pollutants might they create that we don't even know about yet?
That's a great question. The legal battles of the future, they might be about things we don't even have names for right now. And will Massachusetts v. EPA be used to regulate those new unforeseen pollutants? Will it be a tool for innovation and protecting the environment? Or will it end up being an obstacle to progress? Those are the kinds of questions that lawyers and policymakers are going to be wrestling with for a long time to come.
It's a reminder that the law, it's not just some fixed thing. It's alive. It has to adapt to new challenges and how we understand the world, how that's always evolving.
Yeah.
Massachusetts v. EPA, with all its complexities and controversies, it's left a real mark on environmental law.
It has, yeah.
It's a case that still sparks debate, shapes legal strategies, and inspires those who are fighting for a healthier and more sustainable future. So keep learning, everyone. Keep questioning. Stay curious. We'll catch you next time on The Deep Dive.